Now on to our special speaker, John West. And John's had a long career as an international economist with major stints at the Australian Treasury, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and the Asia Development Bank Institute. He currently teaches Asia's economic development at Tokyo's Sophia University. He's a contributing editor to the Financial Times Intelligence Unit. He's also executive director of the Asia Century Institute. He's an educator, he's a journalist, he's a researcher, and he's a policymaker. So we've got all four. And he's written a book called Asian Century on a Knife Edge, which is why we're all here tonight. So with that, I'll hand over to you, John. Thanks very much.
Thank you. So thank you very much, John, for your very kind words of introduction. And a big thank you to Ash for organising the event, and also to Flavia. Is she here? Or she did? Okay. For doing the interview before. And also very grateful for the attendance of the committee members here. But above all, a big thank you to all of you for coming along and sharing the evening with me. It's great to see you. I actually came here in December. You may not recognise me from that. I had a batik shirt on and a pair of jeans, and I was just travelling like a backpacker, and my good friend Alan Gingell was making a speech here, and so I came along to that, and Alan made a great speech, and I had the pleasure of meeting a number of you, including John, and asked if I could come back and present my little book. So thanks so much. It's great to be back here in Perth. Even though I'm an old man, I must say that December last year was the first time I came to WA. I just love it out here. It's fantastic. And so this time I came over on the train, and it's a very great trip, so I recommend it to any of you. I've done a few big train trips. I did the Trans-Siberian one, and I did Canada coast to coast, but the Indian Pacific is by far the best. So as John said, I'm going to make a little presentation about my book, Asian Century on a Knife Edge. So why did I spend 2.5 years of my life writing this book? In short, I'm really fascinated. I'm sure that most of you here are fascinated by the whole economic, social, and political transformation taking place in Asia. What's happening in Asia really is, it's historic. And but there are also three more specific reasons why I thought that I wanted to write something on Asia. And firstly, one specific reason is that I believe that many Australians have succumbed to a case of Asian century hype. What I mean is that lots of Australians have a too rosy picture of what's happening in Asia. And, you know, Asia's done some fantastic things in the last couple of decades. But I think that, you know, there are many fractures in the Asian economic model and political model, and the future ahead is not assured. Another point on this Asian century hype, I've noticed that some Australians, particularly in the business sector, seem attracted by the authoritarian style of governance that there is in some Asian countries like China. And you know, it seems a more efficient way to do things if you don't have democracy, if you don't have an opposition. But I think that's a very worrying and dangerous trend. So I believe that although Asia has made great things in these last few decades, Asia faces many challenges looking ahead. And its development is not assured, it's not guaranteed. And so, as I have in the title of the book, Asia's future is sitting on a knife edge. Could be good, but may not be good. Second reason why I decided to write this book, I think many Australians have a China obsession. You know, it's true that China is the world's biggest economy by some measures. It's true that China is Australia's biggest economic partner. But there's a lot more to Asia than China. And, you know, I predict, according to my analysis, that India will become the world's biggest economy over the coming century, and that it will overtake China. According to the United Nations, India's population could be 1.5 billion by the end of the century, whereas China's might only be 1 billion. So 50% more in the case of India. Also, India already is more active in reforming its economy, and its economy has been growing faster than China for a number of years. So don't forget India. And as India overtakes China, according to my prediction, this is going to, you know, shake things up a little bit. As I look at India, you know, I see India has many things going for it. It's a democracy. It's a bit of a messy country in a way, but it's a democracy. And its democratic institutions are pretty solid. It has the world's biggest elections, which seem to work. And I think that India might be more politically resilient than China looking ahead. It's really difficult to see the Chinese Communist Party still in power in 80 years' time. But I mean, that's just my feeling. So I applaud the Australian government as they now have a new India economic strategy. I think it's a very good thing to have the India economic strategy, but much more needs to be done to implement this strategy. Also in Asia, not just China, Southeast Asia. Lots of people forget Southeast Asia. And, you know, Indonesia is our closest big neighbour, very important country, Indonesia, and 260 million people. It's been growing pretty well over the last two decades, a democracy. They have elections coming up. There's much to be looked at. And again, I applaud the free trade agreement that the government has recently signed with Indonesia. It still has to be ratified by both governments, but this is very important in terms of developing relations between Australia and Indonesia. So that was my second motivation, China obsession, and there's more to Asia than China. My third motivation for writing this book was the China threat syndrome that has taken hold in the US. Many of the things that Donald Trump says about China are true, in my view. I mean, there is a China problem in many ways. But to me, the biggest threat that America faces is not China, it's America itself. You know, Washington has allowed the US to become a polarized, divided country as globalization and technological change have swept through the country. Instead of giving tax cuts to the rich, you know, Donald Trump, the US government, needs to invest more in education, invest more in research, invest more in infrastructure. And the US, I'm a big fan of the US. The US does many great things, but you know, they really need to invest more in the economy and the society looking ahead. And if the US doesn't do that, it could become a bit like India today, a country with billionaires, paupers, and lousy infrastructure. America would also be stronger if it valued the friendship of its traditional allies, like Australia, like Japan, like Europe particularly. And, you know, many European countries share Donald Trump's concerns about Chinese trade policies and cyber activities. And, you know, he should do more to sort of be friends with all of his traditional allies, because we're all stronger if we work together. The US would also make a lot of sense if it joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. You know, the TPP was designed by American business, for American business, pushed onto everyone, and then they pull out. It's crazy. So there are a few of the reasons why I decided to invest a couple of years of my life writing this book. So now I'd like to move on to the heart of the book and give you the main conclusions. The book actually has two main sections. And before I go on, I should say that the book is freely available online. You know, I didn't bring any copies to give out or to sell to you, but you can read it freely online. And so I encourage you to do that if you have some time to waste or if you're feeling a bit sleepy. So the first main section is a stocktaking of Asia's economic and social development. Where are we at in terms of Asia's economic and social development? And the second main part is seven challenges for realizing an Asian century. I focus on these seven challenges which I think are critical for Asia. So, stocktaking Asia, where are we at? The first point that I argue is that although Asia's economies have developed very rapidly, Asia's actually suffering from stunted economic development. What I mean by that is that no large Asian economy has caught up with world leaders like US or Germany in terms of GDP per capita, in terms of economic, business, and technological sophistication. There's no likelihood of that happening in the future. Back in the 1980s, the Americans were worried about Japan overtaking the US. Japan had a financial crisis around 1990, and with its aging population, it's been slipping back. You know, in terms of the stunted economic development of Asia, one telling statistic is that in Japan, productivity in the services sector is only half that of the manufacturing sector. And a similar story can be told for Korea and China. And these three countries, all of them, are suffering dramatically from aging populations, which are dragging the economies down. So stunted economic development haven't caught up with the world leaders in terms of GDP per capita. The second point that my conclusion of the stock-taking, we often hear a lot about Asia's emerging middle class. In my view, this is more myth than reality at the moment. Asia's done fantastically in terms of reducing extreme poverty. But getting out of poverty doesn't mean you're in the middle class yet. There's a zone in between poverty and the middle class. And according to my calculations, only about 15% of Asians could be considered middle class or above that. One half of Asia's population is somewhere between poverty and the middle class. And so, they have enough money to feed themselves, to buy a few clothes, but nothing much more. And of course, many people in the zone between poverty and the middle class, they are living in near poverty. They're living in a world of vulnerability. And one thing that we have in Asia, which is prevalent in poorer countries, lots of people are working in the so-called informal sector. One day they've got a job, next day they don't have a job. One day they might work 10 hours, next day 5 hours. And so they're earning enough to survive, but very precarious existence. So, to me, the emerging middle class Asia, it's still pretty much a myth. Moving on to my third conclusion, we hear a lot about Asia's emerging superpowers, China, India, and Indonesia. In my view, these superpowers, they are still fragile superpowers, and China particularly, to my mind, is fragile. China, of course, is making great strides in the technology area, and of course, we've all heard about Huawei and the fantastic things that Huawei is doing. But that's not the whole China story. China's weighed down by enormous debt. The total debt in China is over 250% of GDP, enormous, aging population, and weak productivity. And part of the problem in China is that China's reforms have really been on hold for the last 10 to 15 years. In 1978, Deng Xiaoping launched a reform in China. Then, after Tiananmen Square, he launched a new wave of reforms. Then, in the early 2000s, when China joined the WTO, again, new reforms. But since then, basically no reform at all. And that's one of the reasons why the Chinese economy is slowing down. Another sign of fragility in China is that China's society and politics is increasingly held together by repression and control of the people. If us Australians were Chinese, we'd go berserk in the Chinese situation. We're not used to people telling us what to think, what to read, and so on. And of course, China's international behaviour is quite aggressive, and China has very few friends. It has lots of countries it does business with, but real friends, North Korea, Pakistan, not much else. So the economic power of China and India and Indonesia, it's not because they're advanced economies, it's because they have big populations. Their GDP is big because they have a big population. Now, that's helpful to have a big population and a big GDP because you have a big market, so people are interested in selling stuff to you. In the case of China, you've got lots of money, so they can do things like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And, of course, big countries with lots of money, even if they're backward, they can invest in the military, so they're strong. Singapore, on the other hand, very advanced economy, but it's tiny, so it can't have a big military. So, Asia has China, India, Indonesia, fragile superpowers, which can't in any way, I think, be compared with US, Germany, or even Australia. My fourth conclusion concerns the US. And over the past 70 years, the US has done lots to help Asia develop. through its open markets, its security arrangements, and of course we have our own alliance with ANZUS, with the US, and of course the international liberal order that the US created after the Second World War. And in contrast to what Mr. Trump thinks, this has also made the US stronger. The US does much more business in Asia than it does in Europe. And of course the US has had many friends in Asia, you know, in part because of the soft power, the attractiveness of the US. But this seems to be changing under Donald Trump. You know, Japan, Korea, Australia, Southeast Asia now feel that Donald Trump is a little less reliable than he used to be. You know, sometimes he says good things, and sometimes he's, you know, ministers, secretaries of state and so on say good things, and the next day they say the opposite. So that's my sort of a downbeat assessment on the state of Asia. Asia has done fantastic things, but it's only climbed the ladder a few rungs, and it faces many challenges looking forward. And so I identify in my book seven main challenges. I'll run through these, and then after that come back to the, you know, the international relations aspects of this, which I think is the most of interest to yourselves here. So challenge number one, getting better value out of global value chains. I teach in Tokyo at Sophia University, and I always ask my students, where was your iPhone made? They all say China. And of course, that's not true. The iPhone is made in a global value chain. It starts in California with the design and conception of the iPhone. Then it picks up components in Korea, Japan, Taiwan. They are put in the iPhone. Then it is assembled in China. And the value added in China, and it's assembled by a Taiwanese company, not even a Chinese company, the share of the value added in China is only about 10%. Most of the value added is actually in California or in the high-tech components. And so in these value chains like this, Asian countries like China are not getting much value as yet. They are not leaders of value chains. The same story could be told about my shirt, which is, says it's made in Vietnam, but in fact it was really designed in Paris, you know? And the material comes from Milan and so on. And our friends in Vietnam, they just sew, trim, and cut. They get a couple of dollars or a couple of cents out of the shirt. And so the challenge for Asia to really develop is not just to be the outsourcing place where iPhones are assembled and shirts are sewn together. It's actually to become a creator of products, to lead the value chains. And at this point, Korea and Japan are doing okay, but apart from that, not really other countries. China's very keen about this issue. They understand the problem, and they're doing lots to try and upgrade their economy, become more of a leader. And of course, Huawei and other companies are doing some good things. But, you know, they're finding it a great challenge to climb up these global value chains. Countries like Malaysia and Thailand, which have been participating in value chains for a long time, have not managed to graduate to high value added activities. And, you know, they are stuck in what we call a middle income trap. They're climbing the development ladder, but they're stuck. They're not creators of new products, creators of value added. The second challenge that is really crucial in Asia is making the most of urbanization. Over the last few decades, people have been moving from Asian countryside to towns and cities at a world record rate. It's fantastic, the urbanization that's taken place. Now in China, about 55% of people live in urban centers, whereas a few decades ago, it was more like 20, 25%. Now, this is driving economic growth as people move from the farm to factories and services sector and so on. And, you know, it's I'm sure you've visited Asia, and Asia, in fact, has some of the world's best cities, Singapore, Tokyo, Seoul. In these advanced Asian cities, governments have tried to copy America and create Silicon Valleys, become very innovative, but it hasn't really worked. You know, we've got some nice cities in Asia, but we don't really have, as yet, great innovation cities like San Francisco or, you know, Boston or places like this. What is also more worrying is that although Asia has some of the world's best cities, it also has some of the world's worst cities. And I've visited All of them, I think. Dhaka, Calcutta, Manila, Jakarta. Has anyone been to Dhaka in Bangladesh? Don't go. You've been? How was it? Very, very nice people. And they're getting better at cricket. And so, you know, these cities, of course, you know, they're a disaster in many ways. And, of course, they're not helping the economy. Such cities are often exposed to the effect of global warming. And, you know, as we look ahead, cities in close neighbours of ours, Indonesia and Philippines, could well be producing climate change refugees. And, you know, that's something that Australia will have to think about more in the future. So urbanisation, it's happening at a big rate, but it's not really as successful as it should be. Number three in terms of challenges, what we call inclusive development. It's a horrible term in a way. What it means is giving all Asians the chance to participate in the economy and the society. Now, in all of our countries, there are certain social groups that suffer from discrimination, prejudice, persecution. Even in Australia, we know that things are not perfect. But in Asia, the situation is much more grim than it is for in Western countries. You know, some of the groups that suffer greatly in terms of discrimination, women, you know, youth, because we have very hierarchical societies, LGBT, our neighbour Indonesia, it's the poor LGBT people, and of course, indigenous and religious minorities. According to some people, that if women could participate in the Japanese economy at the same rate as men, Japan's GDP would be 15% higher. And, you know, and Japanese women, very well educated, very smart people, but of course, male-dominated society. And so to realise an Asian century, one important thing will be to give everyone a chance. And that is just not happening now. And we, of course, in Australia, we debate these issues a lot, but, you know, it's in Asia, minorities of all types have great difficulty being part of the society, being part of the economy. Challenge number four, demography and ageing populations. Asia has some of the world's most rapidly ageing populations, Japan, Korea, China, and so on. Of course, this is dragging the economies down. For example, in China, the working age population has been declining for the last 6 years. This means that 1 year to the next, less and less people, you know, to work in the economy. And in Japan, working age population has declined since 1995. And so countries like Singapore and Hong Kong have a similar issue, but they, like us, they're open to migration. But so aging populations, big, big issue. And Japan, it's only been growing at about 1% a year for the last 20 years because of that. On the other side of the coin, we have Asian countries with youthful populations, India, Indonesia, Philippines. They also have challenges. The challenge that they have is providing decent education and also providing jobs for the young kids. And you know, as we saw in the Arab Spring, if you have lots of young boys who are poorly educated and don't have an opportunity, you can have social explosions. And so the population, demographic story in Asia, very challenging. One win-win solution for in Asia on the demographic side would be more migration, migration from labour surplus countries to labour deficit countries. But there's too little migration really at the moment. You know, it's Asia's skilled migrants, where do they come to? Australia, Canada, US, New Zealand. You know, they don't go to Japan or Korea. And Asia's lower skilled or unskilled labour, where do they go to? Very often to the Middle East. And so it's a really big missed opportunity, migration. So that was four challenges. I have two political challenges. One is democracy. You know, many people were very positive about the idea of economic development and democracy. And people who had this optimistic view looked at the cases of South Korea and Taiwan. They used to be authoritarian governments, and they democratized, and now very mature democracies. But in the case of China, many people hoped that China would follow suit. Hasn't happened. If anything, China's been going backwards in terms of authoritarian politics. Now, China's authoritarian system may have been effective in the first few decades of its development. It enabled it to sort of rush up the development ladder by investing in infrastructure and opening our markets and so on. But this is no longer the case. You know, there are many great costs, I think, of the China's authoritarian system in terms of loss of personal freedom, abuses of human rights. As I mentioned earlier, costs for the economy. If you want to become an innovative, creative economy, you need to allow crazy people the opportunity to express themselves. And you look at some of the great entrepreneurs in America, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, all these types of guys. Can they succeed in China? Maybe not. In China, we do have some good entrepreneurs like Jack Ma from Alibaba, but he has to sort of kowtow to the Communist Party. So, politics not in a good situation. Number six, my sixth challenge, this is economic crime. As Asia has moved to the centre of the global economy, it's also moved to the centre of the global criminal economy. And criminal economy, I mean, human trafficking, smuggling, intellectual property theft, money laundering, corruption, cybercrime, the list goes on. And, you know, I just saw an OECD report coming out yesterday on counterfeiting. And, of course, counterfeiting is booming in Asia. And, of course, China is the world capital for counterfeiting. Now, counterfeiting, of course, when we're a tourist, we all like buying counterfeit things. You know, it's all nice. But, you know, counterfeiting has many costs. Innovators, of course, have no incentive to innovate if they know their product is going to be ripped off. But what is all more troubling is many counterfeit products have bad safety points to them. For example, counterfeit medicine. If you go to a pharmacy in China and buy your blood pressure tablets and it's counterfeit, what's going to happen to it? There are even stories of, you know, parts for aeroplanes which are counterfeit. You know, a plane is to change a part. And so the safety aspect of counterfeited products, very important. My seventh challenge, you'll be pleased to know I've reached number seven already. This is geopolitics. And, you know, the relative peace that Asia has enjoyed for the past 70 years has fostered economic growth. Very important, having peace. But now we're in the midst of geopolitical competition between China and the US for political leadership in Asia. And so this is changing. Now, I'll come back to this issue at the end of my presentation because I think it's most interest to this group. And so my overall assessment for Asia's leading economies is that they're not tackling these challenges sufficiently. Japan has been avoiding reform for two decades. Korea and China also avoiding reform. Vested interests block reform. In the case of China, Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, they're concerned about stability. They don't want anything going off the rails. And of course, when you open up the economy, you get things start to happen. And so these are factors blocking out the reform and blocking Asia from realizing a successful Asian century. So my view is that the economic dynamism in many Asian countries will fizzle out over the coming decades, much like Japan's dynamism fizzled out. As I mentioned earlier, Japan has been growing at 1% a year for the last 20-odd years. Strangely, however, Mr. Trump, our friend across the Pacific, he could be a strategic gift to China. If he can succeed in pushing China to reform and open up, that would be good for America, big for the world economy, but above all, it'd be great for China. He's pushing China to do what China needs to do. And so hopefully that will succeed. So what about the future for the Asian century? Asia accounts for about 40% of the world economy today, and roughly about the same as the West. If Asia muddles through in the coming years, it will then have the biggest share of the world economy. China and India, biggest economies. Indonesia, fourth. And so you could say, well, you know, Asia's, you know, the biggest part of the world economy. This is an Asian century. And but Asia's leading economies, biggest economies, would still be way behind the West in terms of GDP per capita, economic, business, and technological sophistication. So to my view, this is a weak Asian century. Asia's big is backward compared with the West. On top of that, there are so many flashpoints between Asia's countries. You know, North Korea and South Korea, North Korea and Japan, Japan and China, South China Sea, China and India. So all these tensions between Asian countries, it can make you wonder, does Asia even really exist? Or are they just a bunch of countries that happen to be there? You know, and compared with Europe, you know, Europe has its problems, but there's no chance of France invading Germany or Germany invading France. But in Asia, it's different. So that's my view about the future of the Asian century, that it's, you know, a weak Asian century with Asia still being big but backward and with tensions between countries. So now I'll come back to my seventh challenge, that of living together in peace and harmony. And this is the most important, I think, for our group here. As you all know, since the end of World War II, the US has been a great power in Asia, provided security to allies like Australia and partners, offered open markets, including to China, and led the liberal international order, which allowed Asian countries to develop. But now China has made it clear that it wants to become the leader of Asia. This is ironical, as I said, because, you know, China is way behind Japan, Korea, Taiwan, you know, Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia in terms of GDP per capita, democracy and human rights. But China is big, and China is now throwing its weight around. It wants to be the boss of Asia. It believes that Asians should manage Asia. It doesn't like the US having alliances with Japan, Korea, and others. Japan likes to have an alliance with the US. But according to China, no, you shouldn't do that. And you know, it's clear it wants the US to leave Asia. On top of that, China has taken several initiatives to demonstrate regional leadership, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Belt and Road Initiative. Some analysts have argued that this rivalry between the US and China will lead to war. You've all heard about the Thucydides trap. This is the idea that, you know, back 2,000 plus years ago, Athens was a rising power and went to war with Sparta, rising power and existing power. And Thucydides was a Greek historian who wrote all about this. So people are worried we could end up in war. But at the same time, many people argue, and I think it's pretty true, we're already now right in the middle of a Cold War. Different from the old Cold War, but a bit of a Cold War. And the tensions between the US and China now are very, very strong. The whole US establishment sees China as a strategic competitor now, not a partner. This new reality has many different aspects. Cyber conflict, information war, trade war, technology competition, Huawei and the US, but also competition for allies. China seeking to become friends with Southeast Asia and other countries, taking away, you know, friends from the US. We don't know how all of this will end, but it's a very tense situation now between China and the US. And, of course, a country like Australia, we're sort of caught in the middle of this a little bit. So what does all this mean for Australia? So Australia is now caught in the crossfire between China and the US in light of our close economic partnership with China, our military alliance with the US. Australia needs to be more vigorous, more aggressive in doing several things. Firstly, diversifying our economy. You know, we're so China-dependent now. Out of the G20 countries, Australia is the most China-dependent country. And the obvious things are India, Indonesia, developing better relations with those economies. Secondly, pushing the US to stay in Asia. The US has lots of reasons to remain engaged in Asia. As I mentioned earlier, it does much more trade and investment with Asia than it does with Europe. And so trying to convince the US to remain in Asia and remain our friend here in Asia. We need to do better also at managing relations with China. And I mean, obviously, we're quite different in many ways, but you know, we can work together with China. We need to stand our ground and defend our interests when appropriate. We also should try and convince China that it's in its interest to strengthen its soft power, to be a nice guy. Also, Australia needs to be more active working with other countries like India and Japan. What Australia did with Japan, in terms of reviving the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is a very good example of cooperation with another country. You don't have to be with either the US or China. There are other countries around. And there are many, you know, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, India, all of these are other partners we need to be very active in befriending. The other last thing I'd like to mention is that Australia needs to be prepared for. We need to be prepared for surprises. You know, my mother went to East Germany in 1988, and the tour guide said, oh, that wall, you know, that won't be here forever. That'll be gone in about 40 years' time. Of course, the next year was gone. And, you know, if you think back to over the last few decades, so many historical surprises occur. You know, black swans or grey rhinos, people call them. And so we need to be really prepared for these things. And, you know, a couple I'd like to mention, you know, China and the Communist Party seem rock solid, you know, now. And Alan, when he was here in December, oh, yes, you know, China, the Communist Party will be there forever. But, you know, history shows that authoritarian regimes don't last forever. You know, we don't know how things change, but, I mean, things do change. And, you know, even in China in recent times, when Mao died, we had a big change with Deng Xiaoping. And of course, now we have a big change happening with Xi Jinping. If you look over China's history over time, China's been up and down all the time through its history. And so, you know, it's hard to see China and the Communist Party being there forever as it is. And a lesson of history is that often when things change, they can change more quickly than we realize. Another thing which I think we need to be careful about is Asia is the world capital for natural disasters. And we have this ring of fire around the Pacific area. And, of course, this leads to earthquakes and tsunamis and so on. But on top of that, now with climate change, that's another factor provoking natural disasters. And, you know, Australia will probably find itself getting drawn into, you know, natural disasters when Indonesia and Philippines have, you know, more and more typhoons and tsunamis and so on. And we can't escape some degree of regional responsibility for helping these countries. And that could involve accepting large numbers of natural disaster refugees. On the ethnic side, the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar shows how vulnerable Asia can be to ethnic unrest too. And the Rohingya is one case, but in Indonesia, there's so many different ethnic groups, you know, not just all Malays, India, so many different ethnic groups too. And of course, India has not just different ethnic groups and tribal groups, it has the world's second or third biggest Muslim population in a country where we have Hindu nationalism, which is very strong. And so social stability is something there. The last point that I'd like to mention is the case of Taiwan. You know, China now, Xi Jinping, is expressing his impatience about the Taiwan situation. He says we can't keep postponing the Taiwan issue for generation after generation. You know, Taiwan must come back to the motherland, to China one day. One day soon, he means. At the same time, of course, the Taiwanese people, particularly the younger people, they have no interest in being part of China at all. They're just happy with how things are. And the Trump administration is becoming more active in its support for Taiwan, selling arms to Taiwan and improving cooperation, allowing deeper exchanges of people between government officials. And so, you know, if we're thinking about how some sort of conflict between the US and China might take place, Taiwan could be the issue around which a conflict could take place. And from the Chinese Communist Party's point of view, Taiwan is existential. You know, for them, it's their sovereignty, their thing, and, you know, they just want it. They would die for it. And so, so this is a few surprises, and, but there's plenty others, you know. I think history shows us that many of the surprise events in history, we just don't know. But I think we need to think, though, about what can go wrong, because things will always go wrong. Of course, we're sitting down here in Australia with our 25 million people, with a big continent. You know, We've got all that happening above us. We really need to be well prepared for whatever is going to happen. So thank you so much for listening. That's the points I wanted to mention about my little book. And the great thing about making a presentation like this, and I've made a few now, is all the questions that people ask, because people always come up with new ideas or critical points that I never thought of. And so I've learned more about my book since I published the book than before. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks, John. Well, while the speech has been on, you've been watching How to Hold a Mic. Am I doing okay? I'll just mention one thing, and that is we're filming tonight, and that'll go online. If anyone's got an issue with that, we can turn it off while you ask your question. We're happy to do that. I'd also like to introduce Molly Rogers-Thompson, who's our new secretary of the Institute, who's going to ferry the mic around to anyone who has a question. So over to you, Molly. First question, Samina.
Thank you very much. I hope I'm holding it the right way. Enjoyed your presentation. What I'm a bit sort of confused about is that you seem to apply a standard or criteria set of that to the Asian countries that you don't seem to apply to the Western countries that you identify as developed, which we recognize as being developed. The fact that there is authoritarianism, I think America is a democracy, but the way Trump government has shown that it can also be derailed, I think that could equally apply to that. And what I was really intrigued was your reference to oppression of women. I'm not denying that it doesn't happen in Asia, but the fact that minorities are not treated well in Asian countries and women have a lot of problems, I think that's, again, you know, Me Too movement is a clear indication that it happens everywhere. So I don't know if that's a valid criteria to be applied. And the other bit that I'm a bit intrigued about is that you apply the criteria to China and Japan in terms of the age the population makes, but when it comes to India, you haven't really given us an understanding of why you think that India would not be one of the examples, you know, those who have a promise and then they fail that promise. Because years ago, Pakistan was identified as the rising Asian country. Didn't come to anything. Japan, you have said that hasn't really reached its potential. So what is it that makes you think that the same factors that you think would guarantee that Asians are not going to be that significant do not apply to India? So I'm just intrigued in your special treatment of India without giving a lot of data as to why you've come to that conclusion. So if you could give some explanation for that, please.
Your first point about problems in the West, it's a very important point. I wrote my book only on Asia, and it's true that, you know, maybe I give the impression that everything's great in the West and Asia has nothing but problems. And of course, that's wrong. You know, I think on average, Western countries are ahead of Asian countries on average, but we have enormous problems in the West, and you know, the whole world has problems. This is the nature of life. And you know, the authoritarian politics in the US, it's really a big problem. And, you know, to me, Brexit is just madness, you know. So I agree with you fully that, you know, we have lots of problems in the West. And it's true that when it comes to things like treatment of minorities, be they, women's not really a minority. In fact, women are the majority of the population. But, you know, the treatment of women in the Western countries, maybe it's better than Asian countries on average. But, of course, it's not as good as it should be. There's no doubt about that. And, of course, the Me Too movement only highlights, you know, some of the problems we have here. The fact that the Me Too movement is allowed to exist and allowed to be active shows a positive aspect of Western politics. You know, it's not really allowed in China, and it's certainly not allowed in Russia. So I agree with you that we shouldn't be triumphal, shouldn't have triumphalism about the West. The case of India, you know, I'm not sure if I fully understood your point on India, but are you of Indian origin or?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Okay, I can give you just a few quick points. Firstly, you know, China's power or China's importance today is basically because of the size of its GDP, and that's basically because of the size of its population. Now, looking ahead to the end of the century, China's population is declining, and India's population will be quite a bit above it. So it'll be a bigger country in terms of population. Secondly, in terms of market-oriented reform, India is being more active than China at the moment, and that's reflected in the higher growth rate. And in China, you still have many people who are still a bit Maoist. I think in India, you know, my observation is that Indians are pretty comfortable with the open market economy that is happening. And I think lastly, I think that democracy is a big plus in India. In India, you have very innovative, creative society. And, you know, people talk about frugal innovation. You know, Indians can innovate with anything. And so they're my points. But, you know, looking ahead, no one knows what the future is going to hold. And as I looked at all the evidence, that was my conclusion. But I could be wrong. And, Pakistan is, it's a tragedy that the military has such a strong control over the country. Pakistan, of course, is a country with enormous potential, and hopefully one day that you can realize that potential. And for both Pakistanis and Indians, you can only see how great the potential is when people from these countries migrate to the US, Canada, or Australia, then they do so well. And but thank you for your questions.
The question I have is that, first of all, I think your talk was excellent and raised quite a few points that I had not thought about before. It was a great insight into us looking at Asia. But my question would be, how do Asians, what role do they see for Australia? How does Australia fit into this jigsaw? I well remember, for example, what Lee Kuan Yew thought of Australia, and also Dr. Mahathir thought of Australia, and more recently the President of Indonesia. But more generally, do they see a role for Australia, or do they just see us as a European enclave, you know, just welded onto them?
It's an impossible question to answer, but I'll try. You know, I think that the fact that so many Asians want to come and live in Australia is a sign that many Asians think Australia's a pretty good place. And, of course, we now have a very rapidly growing Asian population. It's a good thing. But, I think probably many Asian elites, would see Australia as being like a deputy sheriff of the US. And maybe to some extent we are. You know, Australia has participated in every American war since, the First World War, I think. And, but I think... I mean, Asia is so diverse. I mean, countries like Japan and Korea, South Korea, they look on Australia very favourably as a fellow middle power that is a good country to work with. And Singapore too, they have a very good relationship with Australia and see us as being a very positive ally. And India too, they like us. And I think that with the US becoming a little bit unstable as it is, that's a plus on Australia's side. And so, there is this old-fashioned view of Australia as a deputy sheriff of the US, which we still are to some extent. But I think that the more advanced Asian countries look upon us very positively as a partner.
Michael. Thanks very much. My name is Michael Wood, and I used to work for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade until recently. And I have to say I agree with almost everything you say. At a fundamental level, I think you've really captured an error in the way Australia is positioning itself. I do agree with Samina. I think you're way too positive and optimistic about India, but that's another matter. But my impression, it's more a comment than a question, I guess, is that over the last couple of decades, Australia has pursued relationships with Asia almost purely for economic benefit. This is not, I'm not trying to cast too much of a moral judgment on this, but it does seem that we've debased ourselves morally in other respects. We used to argue with China about human rights, and many parts of Asia we would argue with them about human rights, and we would have concerns that went beyond the pure mercantilism. But it seems over the last couple of decades we've ignored everything else. You know, our psyche has been subsumed by our concern for wealth, and it does seem to me now that Asia, as I suspect you probably spell out in your book, has now reached and is sort of enjoyed the rapid growth that it was going to, starting from down here. We're now left wondering where our future is, and it does seem to me that there are many countries in Europe with which we have much greater value connection, and many more similar values that we have for as long as I've been working in foreign affairs and trade, ignored because they weren't part of Asia. And so my hope is that in the future Australia might focus more on its on those countries with which it has values in common, rather than singularly seeking economic advantage. But my main point was I agree with fundamentally everything you say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I agree with you. Now that we're in this sort of Trump world, and as I say in my book, I think even if Trump is not elected again, I think America has changed a lot. And, you know, America will not be as it used to be. And in this world, new world, it's very important for Australia to foster deep partnerships with countries that we have a lot in common with. And in Asia, there are countries, Japan, Korea, India, and even Indonesia. In Indonesia, it's a new fragile democracy, but it's still doing a pretty good job. And I agree with you that we should foster relations with such countries and not be afraid to speak up to countries that, you know, when we're concerned about things like human rights. So, thank you.
James. China's recently announced a new foreign investment policy, I think with the aim of at least appearing to be much more friendly towards outside foreign investment in China. You're much closer than we are to the action. Can you give us your view of this new policy? Is it really what it seems, or is it just smoke and mirrors?
It is true that in the context of this trade war between America and China, that China is, you know, offering up concessions, offering up, you know, openings in its economy, notably in the area of foreign investment. I don't know the details of the precise legislation, but I've read about it like you. And, you know, if it is implemented properly, it's a positive thing. But the thing that people always worry about is that China announces and maybe even legislates policy reform, but the implementation is blocked by some sort of mechanism. Yeah. So that's the risk.
Thank you, John, for this great presentation. One thing that I would like to bring to awareness is that not only Trump, but today we experience the global rise of populism. So I don't know to which extent Western so-called liberal democracies are living a huge crisis. So to which extent the current political environment that Western democracies are suffering will impact the future of Asia, because everything that you're pointing out is like a development, like we can see trends. So it's interesting to witness that the US, for instance, seems to be moving forward to a political environment where human rights protections and democratic rights could change, and to which extent Asia also might move forward and revisit some of their understanding regarding of human rights. Thank you.
No, but your point is very well taken, and you know, historically the US has been a leader in terms of promoting democracy and promoting human rights. And the democratization that took place in South Korea and Taiwan was pushed along by the US. And the US really is losing its moral leadership in the area, and that will allow people to maybe go backwards in terms of democratic and human right development. You know, my wife is Filipina, and I know that country a little bit, and the president of the Philippines, of course, is a fairly distinctive character, and it's we were discussing earlier with Flavia, and of course he seems like a brother of the new Brazilian president. But this new trend, I mean, I read this morning, in fact, an interesting article by Kaplan. Was it Robert Kaplan? And, of course, for him, the new sort of political scene is authoritarianism versus democracy, and that democracy is struggling to survive in the face of this. And so it is a worry in Asia because even, I mean, according to the Economist Intelligence Unit, there is not one full democracy in Asia. And, the best countries are fragile democracies. And, in Japan, it's a country where I spent a lot of time teaching and so on. Mr. Abe, of course, is a very proactive leader and a great friend of Australia. But in Japan, freedom of the press and other things are going backwards. So democratic development in Asia is threatened. So I agree with you.
I think we've got room for two more questions. One there.
Thank you so much for your lecture. I enjoyed it. I do feel, however, that most of your concerns are minimal. There's a great man that I can highly recommend, which is Pukra Khan. He's written a phenomenal book, The Future is Asia, which is phenomenal. He discusses about how Australia and New Zealand is a part of Asia, and also the development in China and India and the rest of the Asian continent is developing even further because they have to build up their infrastructure. And China, with the economical development, tech development, they're the leading developers in the world with AI, and they're already working on 6G already right now. I would have to say and also ask, how would you see Western sort of countries having more of a development within the Asian sort of region within the world? Because we're seeing this rise with Eurasia. We're seeing the One Belt, One Road coming into fruition now. So I would say that Asia is going to develop even further and probably become the next political and economic superpower of the world.
Yeah, I've not read every word of the book you referred to, but I don't agree with everything he says. I mean, it's obvious that my line is a bit different from that. But, the One Belt, One Road, I mean, there are many countries that have had unfortunate experiences with it. You know that. Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Malaysia, and so on. And as I mentioned towards the end of my presentation, the future is Asian. But, I mean, does Asia even exist? Asians hate each other. They're all... they're squabbling over everything, and but we all have to be modest, and I have written my little piece, that's my view, and maybe Pukra Khan is right, maybe the future is Asian, but according to my sort of reading of the evidence, that's not the case at the moment. But it's an interesting book, and he's a lively, bright guy. Have you seen him or met him? Yeah. He's been in Australia recently, I think, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's been to Sydney.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Alexa.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
And last question over here, Amy.
It's actually a good segue because I was going to ask, John, I know that your book is not Asian Century and you have cast a bit of a pessimistic view on it. So my question is, you as an economist, where does our future lie? Where is the next
big area of growth that our government and businesses should be looking at? It's a very important question, and if I'm right about Asia, maybe the future will not have a big dynamic growth force. you know, if I'm right about India, I mean, India will be important and maybe take the relay from China. That's possible. But, you know, Europe, mainly because of demographics, it can't grow very quickly. The US is already a mature economy, so it can't grow more than 2.5% or 3%. And, you know, other than China or India, there are no other big catch-up economies that would force the world economy ahead very quickly. And so it's possible that, you know, the future may be, you know, without a big locomotive. But let's hope on India, you know, and Indonesia. But it's, you know, Australia has been, since the end of the Second World War, we've been lucky in a way because we had Japan after the end of the Second World War. We've had other Asian countries, you know, Korea and so on, taking about natural resources, then China. So there's always been sort of another locomotive to drag us along. And, you know, it's probably obvious that at some point in time, there won't be one. And maybe that is the occasion for Australia to reinvent itself away from being a natural resource-driven economy to being more of a, you know, a high human capital technology country. And, you know, that will probably have to be the future.